Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for coming back to Lecture 5 and the last one on amanuenses in early modern Europe. So in the lectures so far, I've focused on amanuenses in live interaction with their principals, most iconically taking dictation and copying texts, but also serving as editors, indexers, sounding boards, providers of feedback, messengers, representatives, and occasionally, as I mentioned last time, hidden co-authors, or as someone whose name to borrow when publishing a polemical tract. Amanuenses could also play a central role after the death of the principal in shaping the posthumous reputation and publications of the deceased. In a few cases, the scholars themselves made plans for the fate of their papers and publications after their death. In other cases, in the absence of explicit directives, the heirs received the papers along with the assets most often mentioned in wills. Particularly, these would be the widow and offspring if the scholar had been married. But the amanuensis often had a better understanding of the contents and whereabouts of the papers and of their potential significance to a broader audience and their suitability for publication. So the amanuensis could be a resource to the heirs, given this expertise, or if the relationship was not cooperative, the amanuensis could pursue efforts independently of the family to curate the memory of the deceased. Amanuenses typically enhance their own standing in the learned world in doing this. And that incentive, in addition to feelings of personal loyalty, or at least enough of those to outweigh alternative sentiments, foster generally favorable portrayals of the deceased. I have just one example of a hostile tell-all. The expectation of a secretary revealing juicy secrets formed later and in a vernacular tradition, basically in the 18th century. So in this lecture, I will return to a few cases I've mentioned before and introduce some new ones to illustrate the way amanuenses shape the legacies of their principals. My selected examples focused on the role of amanuenses are part of a much larger story about the personal archives of scholars and literary remains of authors. While specialists of a particular figure have always attended to the formation and transmission of their subjects' papers, often by editing them, there's now recent exciting work by historians examining the more general phenomenon, the factors that have shaped the collections of papers that have come down to us. Michael Hunter's The Archives of the Scientific Revolution of 1998 stands out, in my experience, as a path-breaking book on this topic. And since then, the history of archives, especially in early modern period, has grown tremendously, including attention to personal archives. In their recent studies, Elizabeth Yale, Vera Keller, Anna Maria Rose, for example, have paid special attention to the role of women in managing the papers of deceased scientists of the 17th and 18th centuries. And the papers of literary authors have often been the object of considerable attention for the 16th and 17th centuries, although principally this means lamenting the absence of surviving manuscripts. Roger Chartier, in The Author's Hand and Printer's Mind, has pondered why it was only in the 18th century that literary authors became attentive to preserving unpublished papers and passing them on to executors, and that libraries sought donations of them and later started paying for them, as is the case today. So the contrast with humanists is quite remarkable in that certainly in the 15th century, and even before in the case of Petrarch, humanists actively managed their working papers, saving them, organizing them, planning for their transmission, although admittedly not always successfully. So why do the literary authors wait so long to worry about their nachlass while the humanists are doing so 300 years earlier? One reason for this difference, I suggest, is that scholars belong to a more clearly defined community than literary authors. The Republic of Letters was an actor's category, a term in use at the time. It designated an abstraction, of course, one of those imagined communities that Benedict Anderson had made us attentive to, but a powerful one that gave its members a sense of participating in a collective project that would extend beyond the individual in space and time. Scholars hoped to contribute to that collective project and also to build their own reputation as participants in it, both during their lifetime and through the posthumous legacy of what they left at their death in manuscript or in print. Even if what actually happened after death depended entirely on the actions of others, the first element in shaping a scholar's posthumous legacy was a scholar's own behavior toward his papers and publications and the arrangements he put in place before death. The outcomes and the people involved varied widely. I'll offer my examples in two clusters, starting with cases of the planners and then cases in which the heirs had no directives concerning the papers. So among those who planned for their posthumous legacy, Erasmus takes the top prize. Given that he spent the last 20 years of life warding off Lutherans on the one hand and conservative Catholics on the other, who lobbed virulent attacks and attempts to co-opt him, Erasmus was keenly aware of the potential for the use and abuse of his name and works after his death. Erasmus used a variety of methods to exert maximal control over the dissemination of his publication in his lifetime, threatening and punishing printers who did not follow his directives, but also pushing out a late work while in poor health so as not to leave it in manuscript. In 1535, Erasmus announced to a correspondent the publication of his Ecclesiastes, a massive guide to preaching that he'd been working on for many years, explaining, "Given the weakness of my body, I would rather bring it out even half-finished than leave it to appear as a posthumous child, because I know only too well how unscrupulously the works of dead authors are treated." Erasmus, of course, had devoted much of his intellectual energy to identifying and correcting errors that had accumulated in the transmission of ancient and early Christian texts, and also in his own publication, offering a model for very detailed errata lists. Here is one such example, where one of the points, I suppose, is, I'll get into it. He issued warnings also to those who would reprint his works not to modify them. And in particular, already with Jerome's edition in 1516, he introduced an injunction, which Eusebius reported used by Jerome. And so here is Erasmus talking about using this. "It seemed appropriate to prefix that summons of Irenaeus, which Jerome had placed before Eusebius's chronicle reading. I adjure you, you who may copy this book, by our Lord Jesus Christ and by his glorious advent when he comes to judge the quick and the dead, to compare what you shall write and correct it carefully by the exemplars which you have followed, and also to transcribe this adjuration and place it in the copy which you have written out." So Erasmus is transmitting this as you are going to go forward with what he has left you. Do so carefully and transcribe again. Another kind of injunction appeared in what turned out to be the last edition of the Adages in Erasmus's lifetime, 1536, a few months before his death. And on the last page, in lieu of an errata, there is an Erasmus to the reader, in which he explains, "In the proverb, de medium plus tuto, the half is more than the whole, the following words are to be deleted, from suidas sites marinuses down to and so kings. They are an intrusion and have nothing to do with this passage. I had a secretary who took delight in secretly weaving into my work something of his own. I cited that passage from Suidas in the proverb, well begun is half done, where it fits, but he, either through ignorance or forgetfulness, included the same passage in this most inappropriate place. I ask you, reader, is this the work of a secretary or a forger? Is there a drunkard or an imbecile who would write anything more foolish? I do not say these things merely on suspicion. I have caught his chicanery in other places when I was going over the text and was struck by the incongruence of what had been inserted. Because this was added to the copy secretly, I could not detect it, and it would have escaped our notice forever if a corrector, puzzled by the passage, had not drawn it to our attention. I only hope the fellow has not played the same trick in other places. If he had been a deadly enemy, could he have done anything more unkind than by such additions to hold me up to the mockery of learned men?" So that is quite a parting shot after a very long book, we know, to have included repetitions and very hard to keep track of. It's interesting that he mentions the shocked corrector. This might well be Sigismund Galenius. In an earlier paratext, Erasmus thanks him for careful correction. Erasmus also names him in his will as one of the team of people who will prepare his work after death. Who knows? And in any case, he's blaming the positioning of this sentence. So I just want to point out, you know, this work is thousands of pages long, 4,151 adages, and there's one line there with a Greek quote in it, which doesn't belong, according to Erasmus. Erasmus is right that the Greek line also appears in another adage. This is also from 1536, where he's happy for it to be. But as you recall, we have the copy of a copy of 1523 adages that was used by Erasmus and Nicholas Canius to prepare the edition of 1526. Of course, here we're looking at 1536, where he's complaining back and looking back at this wrongly positioned sentence. But as it turns out, the sentence from Suidas citat et marino to regum igitur appears in the working copy of the Adages of 1523. And in whose hand is this? Erasmus's. So Erasmus is moaning about the forging secretary introducing stuff of his own about a sentence which he had introduced 10 to 13 years earlier. He may well have completely forgotten about that. So it just shows how he, you know, it's very hard to master the whole thing. It's also, I think, what the real significance of this erratum is, to tell people, do not mess with my text, right? He's even complaining wrongly about an amanuensis who did. And as it happens, the Frobenshop did mind this to the reader and removed there, in the next edition, 1541, removed the offending passage. And this has brought to my attention that erratalists actually may not just be for readers to correct their copy, because I haven't actually found that many readers who do that using, you know, a pen to correct their copy. But it's also for printers of future editions, especially for someone like Erasmus, who knows he's going to die, he doesn't know where the last edition is, and he wants these mistakes to be purged of the posthumous editions. So there's another audience for erratalists. Although I would point out that one edition, which is less scholarly, did not attend to the errata list and ends up using the bad sentence, which Erasmus put in himself. As it happens, of course, the adages were abridged, rearranged, even in his lifetime. They were quite beyond his control given their commercial success. But clearly Erasmus is disapproving of any modification to his work. Erasmus was more successful in controlling outcomes through the arrangements he made in his will, first composed in 1527, updated in 1533, and February 1536, 5 months before his death, in July 1536 at age 70. These wills, all of them in Latin, appoint an heir, Boniface Amerbach, a Basel jurist and humanist about 30 years younger than he was and with whom he'd formed a close friendship in the course of his 20 years in Basel. Erasmus also named two executors who were Basel printers whom Erasmus trusted, Hieronymus Froben and Nicolaus Episcopius. This makes eminent sense because after assigning a few gifts with sentimental and economic value to a variety of close friends and associates, Erasmus devoted most of the will to describing how the posthumous publication of his collected works should be carried out. He had already sold his library, printed books and manuscripts that he owned, to Jan Alasko, a Polish nobleman who collected them from Basel after Erasmus's death. So the will is about the disposition of Erasmus's writing, calling for the publication of his Opera Omnia as soon as possible. He designated the printers, Froben and Episcopius, the two executors, the editors, he lists five men who he trusted for the task, even how many correctors to employ and whom, at least two, maximum four, and he set aside good sums of money to be paid to each person involved. Erasmus had also detailed in a letter, so here are the Opera Omnia in four volumes, 1540, which is a remarkably speedy outcome. And already in 1523, he had identified nine categories of works or ordines that he outlined that are observed today in the Latin Amsterdam edition of Erasmus's opera, which is nearing completion after being underway for nearly 60 years. So he is really, you know, envisioning his opus and setting up good resources for people to carry out his will. He'd also been publishing readily throughout his career, so he left just one work in progress when he died, an edition of Origen, which was published a few months later under a dedication by Beatus Renanus, one of the scholars of the Jerome edition team, in fact. So Erasmus tapped a circle of expert friends and scholars to manage his legacy and not his amanuenses. Erasmus bequeathed a considerable sum of 200 gulden to the amanuensis in place at the time of his death, one Lambert Comans. We see here he's signing the receipt, and he is signing from his new position as amanuensis to the professor of Hebrew in Leuven, one Andreas van Gennep. So there's an amanuensis who went on to another position as amanuensis. He'd been with Erasmus less than 1 year because Gilbert Cousin, the long-serving amanuensis, had left to take up a canonry in his hometown, much to Erasmus's displeasure, and hesitating to come back, never did. Gilbert Cousin nonetheless managed to be a part of Erasmus's legacy in a couple of ways. He got a poem of his included in the collection of epitaphs that Amerbach swiftly organized in Basel in 1537. Cousin had a relationship with Amerbach, perhaps not only through his time with Erasmus. They may have met while Cousin studied at the University of Basel. Indeed, Amerbach may have brokered Cousin's entry into the Erasmus household. In any case, Cousin was the only amanuensis, former or current, to place a poem in this volume. It's on the last page, which in a way just preceding poems by Episcopius and Froben, the two printers, is kind of pride of place, easy to find. And I would point out that on the verso of this poem is the, you had it there, is the a Hebrew statement by Sebastian Münster, which I am unable to read. But so it's interesting that Cousin had, in fact, already managed to get a poem of praise for Erasmus in print, in a work of Erasmus, at a time when things were going well before he left for Nozeroy. And so you can see a Latin poem and a two-line, a Greek couplet, in this edition of the Ecclesiastes. And, of course, he reprints these poems later on. And in addition, in his pamphlet, the Ephigies, we get a poem by one Jost Sasbut, where he is praising Cousin's work, indexing Erasmus's work. And my hypothesis is that Cousin was responsible for the long index of the Opera Omnia published in 1540, although I only have this poem to go on to make that statement. So Cousin was definitely involved, but not in a responsible capacity the way Amerbach and the printers were. But Erasmus was exceptionally successful, and obviously he left money. He had no other heirs, having never married, etc. He also had reputation that by producing the opera, everyone would benefit from who was involved. My second example of a scholar who manages his own legacy is Conrad Gessner of Zurich, 50 years younger than Erasmus, not as famous, not as long-lived, nor as wealthy, but nonetheless a scholar with an international reputation and multiple roles in his native Zurich as city physician, lecturer at the university, publisher of famous folios, The Natural Histories, for example, and many works besides. And he well knew the challenges of, leaving manuscripts unpublished after death. In fact, he, in his autobiography, he ends it, where he lists some 65 publications of his own, with 18 works he's left in manuscript, and he explains why. I wanted to list my writings, even those which are not yet dedicated, edited, and incomplete in part, so that if some educated men of stronger age and health and more leisure than himself, and similarly inclined to good studies, could be found who wish to bring them to completion, they could easily ask me. So basically, he's shopping around for young men who might be willing to publish some of his unpublished materials. And in fact, Gessner also did that work for other people. Seven of his 65 books are editions that Gessner made of the manuscripts left unpublished at death by scholars whom he knew sometimes or did not know. So it's unclear if Gessner had an amanuensis in place at the time of his death. I mentioned in an earlier lecture a letter he wrote in the year of his death asking for help, identifying a student of medicine who would be poor and willing to live in his house and be an amanuensis, and the more learned, the better. Gessner had sold his bibliotheca, though, to a former student, one Kaspar Wolf. And we don't know too much about Kaspar Wolf. He's making this arrangement outside his will. Kaspar Wolf noted in one of his posthumous editions of Gessner that he had paid, quote, no small sum for Gessner's library. Other sources revealed that it was 150 gulden, or about 1 year of Gessner's annual income. So it was a considerable sum. What he got for it was not only the books that Gessner owned, but also the manuscripts. And another contemporary former student, Josiah Simler, noted in his biography of Gessner that Wolf had bought Gessner's library for a fair price. So we can presume that the purpose of Gessner selling this material to Wolf on both sides was that Wolf wanted to publish some or many of these works, but it was a very big job. Unlike Erasmus, Gessner had left a lot of things in manuscript. So in some cases, he prepared material for publication and never did bring it about, which is actually a boon for us as historians because we can see here what it looked like. These are clippings from manuscripts and letters and printed books, including marked up with red pencil, the second printed excerpt, things that Gessner found of interest, probably kept in envelopes or pigeonholes, and then Kaspar Wolf has glued them in place in their correct order, and this sheet, along with the whole manuscript, would go straight to the printer and become a book, except that it didn't. And then, of course, once it's used to be a book, it's destroyed in the process, basically. Most famously, Wolff failed to publish what might have been a major botanical work by Gesner, who had published on animals, but who also had written a Historia Plantarum. Instead, Wolff sold Gesner's botanical notes and 1,500 illustrations, and here is the long trail of sales and bequests, which brought it down to being published 200 years later, between 1753 and 1771. So, of course, the work did not have the impact that it might have had if it had appeared in the late 16th century rather than in the 18th century. This saga, of course, presents some advantages for historians because we now have a recent edition of all these images which had been saved and preserved, and some of them annotated by Gesner. Given this rather well-known catastrophe of falling down on the job, it may come as a surprise that Wolff actually did publish several of Gesner's works. So we have two books on diseases of women. We have a collection of Gesner's letters. We have a collection of Gesner's notes on physics at the Carolinum in Zurich. We have some editions of classical texts and some reprints of earlier Gesner imprints. So there are about six works listed as in progress in 1562, of which we have no trace now, items that Wolff did not curate or pass on, perhaps because unlike the botanical materials, with their large number of illustrations, these had no special commercial value. In each of his publications, Wolff played up his role as editor of the material, and all told, basically, Wolff was able to produce about a dozen items, a respectable oeuvre, pretty much consisting exclusively of Gesner materials. So my point here is that scholars often planned their own Nachlass, as Erasmus and Gesner did, but were not able to control it. Their success depended on whom they put in charge, how explicitly, with how much material support and moral suasion. It was high for Erasmus and lower for Gesner. In the category of scholars who planned their legacy, I need to introduce as an outlier to my main geographical focus, which has basically been a line from Zurich to Paris with passing through Basel and Strasbourg, because the case of Ulisse Aldrovandi presents such a great and unusual example of a wife who was directly involved in the work of her husband and then exercised considerable control of his legacy. Aldrovandi devoted great attention to the preservation of his collection of natural specimens, which he willed to the city of Bologna, along with funds to ensure its survival and the publication of his works. He had published only his Ornithologia, in three volumes, and De Insectis before he died in 1605. So the bulk of his natural histories, nine large folios, appeared posthumously during the 62 years after his death. And here is an overview of those works and who is named on the title page. So we can see that starting with the second of these posthumous publications, the books named five different men in combination or alone as variously gathering, editing, or composing works and usually boasting of the greatest effort. Most prominent at first was Johannes Cornelius Utterweer, who succeeded Aldrovandi as professor of natural sciences in Bologna and brought to publication the volumes of the natural histories in 1612, 16, and 21. But very noticeably, the first posthumous volume of Bloodless Animals appeared after the year after Aldrovandi's death with no one named in the title page. But a Latin dedication signed by Francisca Aldrovandi. In this two-folio-page Latin dedication to the City Council of Bologna, Francisca invoked her husband's 50 years of devotion to the cause of erudition, sparing neither effort nor expense for the public good and bringing reputation to the city. And Francisca requested the honor of being counted herself among the clients of the city councilors, as in she hoped for financial support from them in return. I don't know what came of that, but Francisca did parley her situation as heir into some revenue. Although Aldrovandi had bequeathed his collections to the city, Francisca had immediate control of them after his death, and she did not release them until years later, once she had secured an annual stipend for herself from the printer who bought the rights to Aldrovandi's publications. Francisca's is the only learned dedication signed by a woman that I've encountered so far, and signals a woman with exceptional skills and involvement in her husband's work. They had two children who died in infancy, and Francisca's son by a previous illegitimate relationship died in adolescence. So in later years, the household comprised a studious couple and whatever domestici they housed. Francisca Fontana was Aldrovandi's second wife from a family of status and means. Aldrovandi's biographer describes her as a young woman of incomparable beauty and wisdom with ingenious capacities for every discipline. This is much later. I do not know on what grounds exactly. But we do have a wonderful colophon at the end of Aldrovandi's five-volume lexicon of inanimate things, noting in Italian that Francesca Fontana, wife of the most excellent Ulisse Aldrovandi, glued these books of observations on inanimate things. And then, nothing is so base or common that some gain cannot be perceived of it. A variation of the Plinian tag, there's no book so bad that some good cannot be gotten of it. So I suppose the implication is that the act of gluing might be considered below her station, and yet it too was fruitful. Francesca probably also helped copy excerpts from ancient and modern authorities on natural historical topics onto slips. So here you can see classic Aldrovandi method of operation, much like the Gessner materials. But here, rather than reusing letters or manuscripts made by others or printed books, it's really his own hand, but it's been alphabetized and arranged properly by being cut up and moved around and glued. In addition, Francesca brought money into the marriage that allowed them to move into a bigger house, which allowed more space for his work. So the principle of the wife as helpmeet to the scholar, articulated by the Poitingers in 1505, with references to the wives of antiquity holding up lanterns for their husbands, was very concretely put into practice in this case a century later. And by 1700, I would say there are considerably more such examples, facilitated by this shift to the vernacular of many scholarly disciplines, and during the 18th century, too, by a new representation of companionate marriage as productive to the learned man, as Megan Roberts has argued. But during the Renaissance, the dominant trope is rather a traditional one, that marriage risked being a drag on scholarship. Thomas More famously portrayed his family obligation as detracting from his books in the preface to his Utopia. I leave to myself, I mean to my book, no time, for when I am home, I must common with my wife, chat with my children, talk with my servants, all the which things I reckon and account among business, for as much as they must be of necessity be done, unless a man will be a stranger in his house. The Spanish humanist Juan Luis Vives signaled a similar expectation about marriage when he congratulated himself in a letter to a friend, "It's been more than 3 years since I've been married. Up until the present, thanks be to God, matrimony has not taken away a single hour of study from me, for which I cannot give clearer proof than my poverty, which sometimes frightens me." He attributed his successful marriage to his wife's excellent upbringing by her mother and grandmother, and since she was a cousin of his, Margareta Valdaura, this was also a compliment to his own relatives. Vives also praised his mother-in-law and his own mother in print in his treatise on the education of women published in the year of his marriage. But Erasmus's reaction to that book makes clear that mentioning family members in print was not the norm. Erasmus scolded Vives for doing so in a letter. "You take pleasure in naming your parents, as Cicero did, and this is certainly a sign of filial piety. But the human mind is envious. They bear it more willingly when strangers to you are praised." In other words, he's warning, boasting of your family is no better than boasting of yourself. Vives responded in a letter defensively that he'd only mentioned his relatives 3 times, and many ancient authors had done the same. This interaction, though, gives us some insight into why family members, and maybe especially women, are so rarely mentioned in print. The potential for disapproval was ever present in the early 16th century still. The real human relations were certainly more favorable than these tropes allowed. We know that Thomas More took pride and joy in raising his daughters with considerable learning. And we catch glimpses of the many ways that wives could help now and then. So, for example, from the History of Plants by Gessner, we have this note on a Delsberger Birnlein, little pear, identified in Latin by the editors as Sorbus aurea, or white beam. "My wife told me about this. They're red, wild, and become ripe and soft soon after the cherries do, with rather similar leaves, 1 mile from Aarau." So, and of course, that's in German in addition. And we know about the Poitingers. I've talked about how, you know, the wife was basically showcased as a learned lady, but we also have private references to her. So for when Conrad is traveling and he needs to access some of his business, he asks his wife to look for them in his papers at home. So this gives you some sense that she knew where stuff was, etc. Of course, women contributed crucially to running the domestic sphere. In any case, many an academic wife was the pillar of the practice of boarding students in the professor's home for extra instruction for the former and extra income for the latter, along with other potentially textual tasks. If the wife died or became seriously ill, the boarding was suspended, as Elizabeth Harding has shown of 17th century German Protestant professors, who often preferred to do their teaching at home rather than more public settings. The case of Martin Bucer's household, to which I turn now, offers a good example, on the one hand, of how students who boarded could render services of many kinds, domestic and textual, and on the other hand, is one of a pair of cases in which the family amanuenses managed the scholar's nachlass in the absence of prior arrangements. In short, the relations in this scholar's inner circle could be discordant, as in the case of Bucer, or cooperative, in the next case of Adrien Turneb. So Martin Bucer was the principal reformer in Strasbourg, until Catholic victories led Charles V to impose the Augsburg interim on the city, and Bucer, who attacked the interim, although he had initially signed it, was forced into exile at age 58. He accepted the invitation of Thomas Cranmer to come to England, and in 1549 he took up the Regius Professorship of Divinity at the University of Cambridge and moved there with his family. His family consisted of his wife, Vibrandis, née Rosenblatt, who is an amazing woman. She married four times, including three major reformers, and bore 11 children. So her first husband died very young. Then she married the first of the reformers, Johann Oecolampadius, who was 22 years her senior and lived for just three more years after marrying her. Then, when Wolfgang Capito in neighboring Strasbourg lost his wife, Martin Bucer recommended Vibrandis to him, and they were married for 9 years. When Bucer's first wife, Elizabeth Silbereisen, was dying, she urged her husband and the recently widowed Vibrandis to marry. And interestingly, you see, Capito and Bucer were also close intellectual allies. They were reformers who tried to patch up Zwinglians and Lutherans. And basically, Oecolampadius was more Zwinglian, and the Zwinglians balked on these this document that Bucer and Capito had drafted. So, coming to England, we have a very blended family. And many of these are named in his will. We have the wife. We have a son of Bucer's by his first marriage, who was weak in mind and body, a daughter of Vibrandis and Oecolampadius, a son and a daughter, Agnes, of Vibrandis and Capito, and then two small children born of this new marriage, Martin Jr. and Elizabeth. Then we have Vibrandis's elderly mother and a granddaughter of hers through another offspring. There's a servant girl, Margareta, and two servant pupils, one Guillelmus, who I think came from France, so I'm calling him Guillaume, and Martin Brehme. And for them, Bucer wrote up 7 pages of rules known as the Formula Vivendi. So basically, I'm zeroing in on another very cool source to catch a glimpse of what it's like to be a servant pupil in Bucer's household. So the document is written in the hand of Martin Brehme with annotations in Bucer's hand. It has 25 articles. The first part of the Formula Vivendi describes their activities as students. They need to be pious, honest, obedient, and studious of all the usual disciplines. They should attend disputations at Cambridge, read texts Bucer assigned, and submit every week something written about their progress. The second part describes their roles as servants. They will light fires in the morning, clean Bucer's clothes and shoes, set the table, lead the prayer at mealtime, serve at table when there are guests, put books and other things away, and keep the clocks on time. One of them was expected to be available to attend to Bucer at all times. Bucer also noted that he and his wife were the curatores familiae. They had the authority to give them commands and hear complaints, both. Finally, the two young men also served as Bucer's secretaries. They were responsible for teaching the daughters, keeping a record of incoming and outgoing letters, keeping Bucer apprised of his schedule, and copying texts as requested. Bucer added about this very important task, and difficult, for it was said that Bucer had trouble reading his own handwriting. Quote, when I have given something to copy, let them, insofar as possible, guard against writing defectively. Let them inspect each page to ensure they have written it with care, and not omit any passage about which they have doubts. It seems like he may be speaking from experience here about amanuenses who sort of skip over hard bits. Despite these admonitions, they clearly did good work. Two of them have been identified as the scribes of a manuscript copy of Bucer's De Regno Christi presented to King Edward VI and now in the British Library. Sadly, this wonderful article shows us the beautiful binding of this manuscript, but not any of the insides. So I have not seen the insides, but I think they were probably very nicely written. These arrangements, though, didn't last very long because Bucer died 2 years after moving to Cambridge. In the will he finalized during his final illness, Bucer left small sums in clothing to various children. So I'll just to remind you of who's in the will. He left and larger ones to Capito's daughter Agnes, who nursed him in his illness. She got 100 florins, and to his wife Vibrandis, 600 florins. Of the servant pupils, Wilhelmus was not mentioned, but Martin Brehm was to receive 12 crowns that he could take in cash or in books, in addition to reimbursement for his return to the continent. So he probably had come from Strasbourg. The will also provided the same terms for Margareta, the maidservant, 12 crowns plus moving expenses. In addition, quote, because given her very young age, she will lack for many things henceforth, I adjudge to her alone the golden cup which the King of England had recently given me at Christmas. The will also remembered dear compatriots in Strasbourg, Ulrich Kellius, responsible for many favors. To Bucer, he willed the Thesaurus Linguae Latinae in 2 big volumes. And Bucer especially remembered a former amanuensis turned colleague, Conrad Hubert, a most learned man, dear brother in the Lord and companion in the service of God. Hubert, this is in the will, quote, carried out many labors for me and my family and does so every day until now, even though Hubert was still in Strasbourg, but clearly carrying out business there. Bucer gave him, quote, from my books, whichever he wants, up to the sum of 12 gold coins of Strasbourg, and the books should be appraised as low as possible for him. And to his wife, a piece of cloth, commonly called arras, should be bought to make a dress. So, although Bucer had addressed him as a colleague, Hubert had started as an amanuensis. As a boy of 12, he left home to study in Heidelberg, then Basel, just as the Reformation was underway there, which culminated in the ousting of the bishop in 1529. So soon after his arrival, he started as a famulus and student of Oecolampadius, husband number 2 of Vibrandis, Basel's principal reformer. Oecolampadius appreciated excellent handwriting and shortly before his death recommended him to Bucer. Hubert was 24 years old, was paid 80 gulden per year when he entered Bucer's household in 1531. And documents in the Strasbourg archive show how Hubert rewrote Bucer's drafts, clarified his manuscripts, annotated his letters, adding the topic of the letter, for example, the date, the identity of the correspondent, in order to facilitate storing and retrieving them. We know of other amanuenses who worked with Bucer in the Strasbourg years, Wolfgang Musculus, who went on to teach theology in Bern, Johann Lenglen, who translated into Latin a German treatise on the care of the soul, and Christoph Söll, who joined Bucer's family by marrying the daughter of Vibrandis and Oecolampadius. So we see a very tightly knit community here. Of all these men, 2 played a crucial role in curating Bucer's paper after his death, Martin Brehm, the young servant pupil listed in the Formula Vivendi, and Conrad Hubert, the long loyal amanuensis turned pastor and defender in Strasbourg. So strangely, despite detailed bequests of many things, Bucer did not mention the many papers and manuscripts he left at his death. And in this, her third time as a widow of a reformer, Vibrandis knew her mind. She dissolved the Cambridge household as fast as possible, sold the bulk of the books and papers that were in England, and went back to Strasbourg first, and then on to her hometown in Basel. She did not remarry. As one of the 2 executors named by Bucer, Matthew Parker played a key role in these negotiations. Edward VI and Cranmer were main buyers of the papers, and one scholar has estimated that the price that the papers fetched represented 1/4 of the total value of Bucer's estate. Parker, though, ended up owning a substantial portion of the manuscripts, whether immediately in his capacity as executor or through later acquisition. At the time, he was vice chancellor of the University of Cambridge. He went on to become Archbishop of Canterbury under Elizabeth and to bequeath his exceptional collection of manuscripts to Corpus Christi College, where they formed the Parker Library. And as a result, some Bucer manuscripts are now there. And one of them, this one, contains Bucer's Constans Defensio and the Apologia of Hermann von Wied, which is a 700-page manuscript prepared for publication but not used. The texts were only printed in 1613 in Geneva with a different dedication, different dedicatee. This manuscript was scribed by Martin Brehm, Bucer's servant pupil, and he also wrote a dedication to Parker in his own voice. This dedication added after Bucer's death. Brehm describes himself as not only a friend, but a client of Parker. The book is a New Year's gift. He says, I'm not in your household, but in order to demonstrate my gratitude for your many kindnesses, I am offering you my work and activity, which I've expended in copying this book for several weeks to give you. So there's a sample of Brehm's handwriting. And Brehm went on to study at Paris and became rector of a gymnasium in Lindau in Lake Constance. So Vibrandis did return with one of Bucer's drafts back with her, which had been presented in Manuscript to Edward, and that is the De Regno Christi. This work was printed for the first time in Basel in 1557 with a dedication to the King of Denmark, signed by the most devoted heirs of the deceased Martin Bucer, no one being named. But we do know that Conrad Hubert was involved in this publication. He must have gotten the manuscript from Vibrandis because we have a Lutheran pastor complaining that Bucer's views on divorce in this work were deviant and that Bucer surely would not have wanted them to be publicized and published after his death. So Conrad Hubert is taking the angry, the heat of the angry reader. Vibrandis's otherwise hasty dispersal of Bucer's paper is certainly a complicated thing for Hubert, who worked for years to gather Bucer's manuscript for publication, including exchanging some letters with Brehm. The process was stalled during the reign of Mary in 1553 to 58, when these hardcore and high-profile Protestants in England went into exile, hiding, or to their death. Since Bucer was already dead, the most Mary could do to him was to disinter his remains, burn them, and so actually the first book that Hubert published was an account of how Bucer had been buried, the remains burned, and then reburied under Elizabeth, this moment of great relief for these Protestants in 1561. So this book was printed in Strasbourg at the expense of the Basel printer Operinus, who was also committed to publishing the unpublished manuscripts of Bucer. But then Operinus's death in 1568 was a further complication. So it was another 9 years before the Scripta Anglicana of Martin Bucer appeared in 1577, with a dedication by Hubert, who used the opportunity to praise the deceased, to attack Bucer's enemies, and mention his own contributions. I was not only a spectator, but his helper for about 18 years in his writings, his sermons, in visiting the sick, in resolving the disagreements of the faithful, helping the poor, and recalling those who erred, whatever sect they started to join. Hubert had completed the second volume of Scripta Anglicana, which would have encompassed Bucer's remaining opera, but the printer of the first volume, Petrus Perna of Basel, came under pressure from reformed factions hostile to Bucer and balked at publishing it. So we see a further problem here is that the confessional conflicts are still continuing and Bucer is out of fashion. So Hubert was lucky to get one volume published. He then died a few months later, and the efforts of Hubert's son Samuel to try and publish the second volume of the Scripta Anglicana were not successful. But Hubert is best known, his longest legacy, is some hymns, which had a long fortuna in evangelical repertoire, but largely unattributed. So basically his public legacy was to have recovered and published the English writings of his principal. He did so despite the fact that far from helping in that endeavor, Bucer's wife took pretty active measures to limit and complicate the process. So for a more positive dynamic between amanuensis and family members, I offer the case of Adrien Turneb, professor at the Collège Royal, whose polemic with Ramus I mentioned last time. And Neil Kenny has featured Turneb's family in his fascinating analysis of the strategies of families for upward mobility in the world of literary reputation. Turneb was very much the scholar, an expert in Greek, who'd published more than 30 editions or commentaries or annotations of classical texts by the time of his death in 1565 at the age of 53. And the family transmission was off to a good start with his wife, Madame Clément, two daughters, three sons. From what was likely a modest background for Adrien Seniors, the two sons reached higher office. Odet was appointed first president of the Mint at the young age of 28, but he died before he could take office. Étienne, the longest lived of the brothers, became conseiller in the Parlement of Paris. They were all involved in publishing the literary remains of Adrien Senior. Neil Kenny makes a salutary point that printed statements in the paratext of posthumous publications need not correspond to the realities of the production of these books, but they serve principally to create a persona for the individuals involved and for the standing of the family as a whole, which would redound to all its members. This is what he calls a family function. I love it. In addition to the author function, the servant function, we have the family function. So I have not used any manuscript sources to probe for gaps between printed claims and more private interactions in the case of the Turneb family, and only a handful of letters have been located in any case. So I will be relying on the printed statements with a special interest in the depiction of those from outside of the family who helped. They are named and thanked warmly in print, which strikes me as unusual. One, Jacques Daniel, is described as a former student who'd become a royal official, and the other is described as a friend of long standing, Jean Furdin. Turneb himself had referred to Furdin in his lifetime, in his Adversaria, in this passage, which is really confusing. It's a comment on Vitruvius, so it's all about levers and pistons. And basically the point is that Furdin collated a text very carefully. It's not clear whether it is a manuscript or a printed book, and the question is whether he used the word chalat or kalkat. But so Furdin is thanked here and is my friend, which is, he's never, the term amanuensis is never used. So then we have the first posthumous publication by the eldest son, Odo, with thanks to Daniel and Furdin, who, quote, joined with his old father by necessity, lived with him diligently for many years, and had zealously aided him in his studies, notably because he had learned through long practice how to read his handwriting, which few could. So if this isn't an amanuensis, you know, we see those telling signs of amanuensis here, even though the word is always friend. I mentioned in lecture three how something, work done as a friend, is not mechanical in the sense of performed for another, and that may be what's operating here. So next we have volume three of their Adversaria, which is published as by Adrien Jr., posthumous literary offspring liberated from eternal oblivion and brought to light by the diligence of my mother and the work of the friends of my father. So the mother is not otherwise named, but gets credit. And then a poem by Jean Dorat, one of the Pléiade poets, actually praises Tourneb's wife for her great conscientiousness, and then has this lovely pun asking the dedicatee to protect both Tourneb's libros and his liberos, his books and his friends. So we don't know much about the mother's activities, but nevertheless, she clearly was known to a circle of learned people. In 1580, then, we have a reprint of the whole Adversaria. So at this point, I wanted to mention the 1557, which is here, so slightly out of date, out of order. 1577, it's Ode's turn to sign the front matter. This is an address to the reader in which he explains, he names the amanuensis in order to say that he's dead and can't finish the work, which is fascinating. Jean Furdin, a most learned man, dearest friend to my father, after he'd found these scholia on the first book of poems of Horace among the notes of my deceased father, and had copied them from the autograph and added all the places in the published adversaria that concern this author, decided finally to publish them, but he was prevented from it by death. And so the son acknowledges this work and carries it on. So in 1580, we have the complete edition of the adversaria. And at this point, Furdin appears acknowledged explicitly in each of the indexes accompanying the volume, totaling 82 pages. Of course, he was dead by then, but he'd evidently done the work. In 1600, Wetzner reprints the whole thing, and he interestingly dedicates this opera to the remaining son, Etienne, the other two having died, and thanks Etienne as a printer for giving him the author's autograph. But Wetzner then drops mention of Furdin, and from then on the family ceased basically taking part in presenting Tourneb's posthumous works. So basically we have the brothers taking turns publishing a series of posthumous publications, thanking their mother, one another, and in every case, Furdin, including even after the latter's death, when the shout-out couldn't elicit more work from him, you know, which might be one of the purposes of mention in print. So I want to close with the cases of longest impact on the reputation of a principal by an amanuensis. So you have a little quiz here. This is from a Wikipedia page for someone. A companion during the Basel years expressed a quite unflattering opinion on this person. 2 years I passed in his company. He spent in drinking and gluttony day and night. He could not be found sober an hour or two together, in particular after his departure from Basel. Who is this? Paracelsus. So that companion is his amanuensis for 2 years, who is best known as a major printer of Basel, Johannes Operinus, who was a young man at the time, and who was asked by Johann Weir, what it was like to work for Paracelsus. And perhaps to his regret, Elise Operanus explicitly said he regretted writing this letter, which he wrote after Paracelsus' death. It's a tell-all letter. So he talks about how Paracelsus never changed clothes when going to bed. He didn't know Latin very well. He got lucky with his treatments. He made Operinus sniff some horrible concoction that made him pass out, and he barely was revived. He was prone to violence. He got, and he got drunk. But he also says that when drunk, he would dictate with such good coherence that the most sober person couldn't have done it better. I then translated what he had dictated into Latin as well as I could, and these writings, translated in part by me and in part by others, were later printed. So this is the letter, which you can find in German from Steinmann. I'm not sure it's been entirely translated into English. And of course, it circulated in Latin. It was printed at least four different times, down to 1615, by people hostile to Paracelsus, but also by people favorable to him. So in this case, we have the intimate portrait of the scholar, thanks to the amanuensis. Although interestingly, Operinus then is also, this letter circulated publicly only after Operinus's death, because speaking ill of the dead was obviously a big no-no, and people disputed whether or not Operinus regretted on his deathbed having spoken ill in writing of Paracelsus. Fascinatingly, this interest in Operinus's Paracelsus amanuensis is visible in this 18th century print, which lists, all the various things Operinus did, and amanuensis to Paracelsus is one of them. I'm not aware of anybody else. Of course, there's a third party long after his death, but we can see how this account has been nurtured down to the Wikipedia page. And another one. You have stuck with me so long, and I have not mentioned Milton's Daughters. So basically, Milton's Daughters, the account that he dictated to his daughters in Latin and Greek without their understanding what he was dictating, is told after his death by someone who had served in his household. However, Milton's biography was incredibly politicized. There's national politics, but there's also family politics. There were lawsuits flying around this family. There was a lot of resentments of many kinds. So I take it all with a grain of salt. Of course, Milton became blind. He relied on people to take dictation, Daniel Skinner, Thomas Elwood, his nephews, Edward and John Phillips, and famously, anybody who walked in the door if Milton felt like dictating. So why are Milton's Daughters so iconic? And basically, there's a spate of representation of this, starting in the late 18th century through the 19th century. So these are some images. We have, Google Ngram on Milton's Daughters. And so there was a lot more discussion of them in 1820 than now. We can speak about this comparatively. And I love this book about George Eliot's dialogue with Milton's Daughters. I find with Milton and the story of the daughters, the repressed potential of women who were not educated enough to appreciate what he was dictating to them. And so I love this, 1880 women's magazine talking about Milton's Daughters. Here's a selection, bemoaning the fact that these girls, were servitors of another, whether their father or husband. Suppose Milton's Daughters had been taught to understand and to delight in the stately splendor of the folios they abhorred. Suppose a learned father had gently led them to love the quiet and still air of delightful study. If we gave our girls mental training instead of the arbitrary curriculum of the schools, they would enjoy their own minds. They would be full of resources against stagnation, against idleness and discontent, and the besetting sin of extravagance in dress. So clearly, women's education is a great thing because we won't have Milton's Daughters anymore. So I think Milton's Daughters just becomes iconic of this whole message, including, ceasing having extravagant dress. So, but nonetheless, I don't want to deny that daughters were pressed into service when they didn't want to be pressed into service. I don't tend to believe the Milton's Daughters account is particularly trustworthy or representative. But I have another one for you, which is thanks to the work of Anna Maria Rose on Martin Lister and his remarkable daughters. So Martin Lister wrote multiple works entirely engraved, with, in this particular case, a history of shells. And you can see that this the sign-off is Susanna and Anna Lister painted the pictures, made the images. It's published at his own expense in London, at great expense. And interesting, the Bodleian is the repositor of some of the copper plates that the Lister daughters both, so they drew and then they incised, they limbed the engraving themselves. Of course, this was a huge saving for the father to have this done in-house. And Anna Maria Rus quotes this line of a friend of Lister's writing to him, "I do not wonder that your workwomen begin to be tired. You have held them to it so long to it." And on that note, I have held you very long to it. Thank you very much. I will stop here.